Welcome to Bitches on Comics. I'm your host, S.E. Fleenor, and I'm here with your other host.
My name is Sarah Sentry. Longtime listeners will be aware of that, but...
I thought you were going to say you were a longtime listener.
I'm a longtime listener. First time being the... No, none of those things. I am not a first-time person of Bitches on Comics. However... We are here with a first-time person of Bitches on Comics. P.S. Awkward intros. It's how we roll. But
it's the brand.
It's where we're at this point. But we are here with Natasha Alterisi. Welcome.
Hello.
Hello.
Thank you for
having wild. There is no crowd. I'm alone in my study. But in my heart, there's a crowd.
My cats are excited.
Good. I'm so glad.
My dog is misbehaving. You know, I think that's excitement.
Sure.
So, Natasha, you want to tell us, our listeners, just a little bit about yourself, what it is you do in the wide world of nerddom. And yeah, I think that's enough.
I'm Natasha Alterisi. I am a writer and an artist, mostly doing comics. I do kind of other stuff when I feel like it. I'm really into making zines these days, which allows me to obsess over whatever random thing I'm on at the moment. And then I also, you probably are most familiar with my book, Heathen, from Vault Comics, soon to be a major motion picture. Yeah, so that's me, mostly.
I'm very excited about this soon to be a major motion picture.
Mm-hmm.
We'll come back to it. I do want to start with talking a little bit about how you got into comics. So were you reading them as a kid? What was your like breakthrough comic, the comic that made you just like, oh, I love this genre, must do it?
No, I didn't get to read comics as a kid. I grew up in the middle of nowhere where there were no comic shops. I think I probably also grew up with the notion that comics are like for boys. The first comic I actually read was in college. My Comp 1 professor was into, you know, having us read as many kinds of literature as we could. So we read Mouse, which, of course, is super influential graphic novel. If you haven't read it, what are you waiting for? Go read it. And then after that, I just started picking up stuff wherever I could. I think I read, like, you know, Watchmen and V for Vendetta and then Persepolis and then Saga and just all kinds of stuff. I'm really into, like, indie stuff these days. Yeah.
Well, you're certainly in good company. We really do love an indie comic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of those ones you named, like Mouse, Persepolis, obviously the Alan Moore starter pack. Mm-hmm. Like all of that is absolutely how I got started in comics too. I also was like a, I guess, later reader of comics. Sarah's been reading comics since her little eyeballs opened, I'm pretty sure.
Yes.
She's just like, oh, look, show me a comic. That's my impression of Sarah as a baby.
That is an accurate impression.
Out the womb with a comic in hand.
It really was, yeah.
Sarah's parents were like, this is terrifying. So did you draw as a child then? Were doodles like a part of your work or were you into art or?
Oh yeah, I've always been an artist, I think probably first. Just sketching and drawing like my whole life. Little dinosaurs and the Lion King. I always like to draw Simba and stuff. And I started writing stories too, just kind of here and there, just for fun. But I don't think I ever really thought of myself as an artist until I started working on Heathen, which was just an excuse to try to draw a comic that I wanted to draw and not have to like pair up with somebody else, you know, which is, you know, selfish, I guess. But it was fun. I loved it.
Yeah, definitely. I think to good end, right? Like that worked out pretty well.
Seems to have worked out, yeah.
Yeah, I really love the art style. It's like so distinctive. And then also to me, there's maybe some echoes of like Eddie Campbell and Sienkiewicz and stuff. I really appreciate mm-hmm. the way that it, particularly I think in Heathen, the line work is such a part of that book that I can't even imagine another artist on it. So I think that it's such a interesting self-defined piece. So yeah, that wasn't really a question, but...
No, I get it. No, the sketchy style is really, I think that kind of harbors back to my like fine art training. So, you know, I didn't grow up with comics. I didn't have a particular look in mind for what a comic should be. So I was just sort of, you know, drawing the way I like to draw. pulling from artists, you know, from the fine arts world that I already, you know, knew and admired. And so that kind of, I think, heavily influenced the look of the book.
And I'm kind of curious about the timeline, because I know a lot of your work, but I feel like I have been only reading it for maybe the last like year or two. Mm-hmm. So I know it, but I don't really know like what the progression was. So Heathen was not your first book at all, right? There was comics that you did the art for before that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Heathen wasn't my first, but it was one of my first. I did a short comic with a local writer, Tim Berry, called Lucid, which we did one issue for. We kickstarted it, and it turned out really well. It was very experimental and interesting kind of sci-fi story. And then I did a second series with another local writer, Jackson Compton, called Illustrated Girl, where I drew the first two issues for that. And then, you know, things didn't end up working out for the rest of the series, but we got those two issues, and I'm still super proud of how those turned out. But again, it was just like more finding my style, finding like a way to draw that I think was really valuable.
Yeah. So Heathen was like actually really way early in your career. Okay. Yeah. Awesome. And is ongoing, right? Like it has the story come to a close yet?
It has now come to a close. The last volume, we ended up bringing in Ashley Woods, who is an incredibly talented artist, to draw the last volume for me because I was unable to. But that is now where the story has concluded. Issues 1 through 12.
Yeah. If you're going to find somebody else, I think Ashley Woods, like, oh my God, it's incredible. What was that process like, kind of working with an artist and being on maybe the flip side?
It was definitely like a different kind of side of things. I think it taught me to be a better writer because previously, like my early scripts for Heathen, like the first issue, most of the panel like descriptions are very vague, you know, because I'm just directing myself basically. I'm like, you know what to draw, just do the thing, with very little details. So for the issues that I wrote for Ashley to draw, I had to like really think about it and be clear. I was like, I can't like leave anything out. I can't, you know, or I also can't like be too controlling because, you know, she's an artist. She knows what she's doing. I don't want to be too much of a like, you know, this is the way I see it happening. Like I needed to trust her vision as well and what she could bring to it. And I think we ended up striking a really good balance at the end there. Turned out really good.
This is so exciting. I'm so excited to read the rest of it. Did you always want to do a story that was based in Norse mythology, or how did you come into Norse mythology?
No, I didn't have any like particular interest in mythology, like of any variety. It was purely an aesthetic thing at first. The earliest versions of Heathen, the story was listed in the back of the book. My friends invited me to go to the Ren Fair with them. And they were all going to dress up as various wenches and stuff. And I did not want to dress up as a wench. I wanted to dress up as some kind of a warrior. And I ended up designing a costume for myself that didn't look too unsimilar to what Adis's costume ends up being. And even after, you know, we went to the Ren Fair, I kept drawing the design, like trying to perfect it. But then it sort of kind of evolved into a character. And then I was like, you know, I should explore this a little further. I should see like what her world is. And that's kind of what led me into learning about Norse mythology. I was like, she's kind of got a Viking look to her. Let's explore that. Let's see what where it goes. And, you know, I don't regret that at all. That was a good little brainworm to entertain.
That's so funny to me because I'm just like, is that the first comic that was inspired by like the outfit at a Ren Fair? Because it can't be, right? Like that must have already happened, but we just don't know about it.
I'm sure. I don't think maybe the other artists aren't brave enough to admit that that's where their idea came from, but I bet it has happened before.
Oh, man. I have almost no history with Ren Fairs. Was that something that you went to a lot, or was this like brand new stuff?
That was literally the one and only time I ever went to the Ren Fair.
Gotcha.
Yeah. I've been to like, you know, like regular like crafts fairs, like all the time I used to go, but this was the first like, you know, themed one. And I haven't really done any since, which I kind of regret, that I would love to go again once things are not, you know, dangerous outside.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm. I don't even know, like, especially because it's like seasonal, right? So you can only go certain times of the month. I only went to one as well, and it was perhaps one of the most awkward experiences of my life, because I was going with a couple who at first were really stoked to go, and then they were arguing for most of it. So I just felt like a weird, like, little kid who was like tagging on. And then also it's just kind of funny to see people in Ren Faire costumes like mm-hmm. argue with each other. Listen, I digress, but
my friends were much chiller.
Cool. Yeah, no, and it's not, I want to go back, you know, like, I feel like I didn't quite get the experience.
Gotta give it another try. At least go get your turkey leg or whatever, a funnel cake or something. Watch some people throw axes. That's fun.
Oh my God, I forgot that they have axe throwing.
Yeah. I got to do a little bit of it in my costume. It was fun.
Oh my God. See, I am a baby, and that's why maybe I don't go to Ren Faires or something. Although I do like whenever I go and like there's like somebody playing a weird outdoors pipe organ dressed like a plague doctor or like whatever, you know. You're just like, I don't know if this actually works like timing wise or theme wise, but you know what? You look great. I love the sound.
It works. It works.
Whenever you're doing art, do you listen usually to music or podcasts, or like what's kind of the thing that goes on while you're working on stuff?
Oh, I always have to have background noise. I'm usually either listening to music, or I've got like a playlist of like YouTube videos or some show or something going on in the background. Lately, I've been just watching all kinds of like leftist, like breadtube-y kind of YouTube videos, mm-hmm. and then just like expanding my Spotify playlists like infinitely. I like to make playlists for like specific projects I'm working on.
Yeah, see, this was my next question, is there a heathen playlist?
There is not. I didn't have one at the time. I literally just listened to, you know, whatever music I had on my phone. I didn't have Spotify back then, but I could probably make one. I could like retroactively make a heathen playlist. Now I want to.
Oh, I am like signing up for it already. Like, I will listen to that all of the time. I listen to a lot of like horror soundtracks and stuff whenever I'm working.
That's good. I really love the music for The Ring, the American version of The Ring. But they don't sell like a soundtrack for it. So I just like play the movie. I'll just like play it over and over and just listen to those cellos and stuff. I'm like, that's amazing.
I have been here exactly what you're describing. I have done that many times, because a lot of times it's like, I don't know. I love like a lot of movies from like back in the day. So you'll be like, oh, I don't know how to find this soundtrack that was for a movie from Japan and like the 50s or whatever. Right. And so you just watch the movie again.
Yeah. I'm like, that'll do, I guess. Enough times, you don't have to actually watch. You can just listen. It's fine. It's not distracting.
Essie, did you have some questions about heathen?
Yes, of course.
Yes.
I was waiting for the music listening to during art conversation to wrap.
Yes.
Yeah. So something that really stood out to me about heathen that is both textual and art-based, which is the same thing in comics, which is that it's a very sexy comic, but it's not a salacious comic. Like, really? We see Freya's breasts, like, pretty much every panel she's in, except for, like, two, where she's crossing her arms because she's pissed off, and you're just like, I love you, you're perfect. But, you know, so much of comics, when we show naked women or we show naked people with breasts, they're so sexualized. Or if we show them even clothed with breasts, I mean, I'm thinking of Power Girl. You know, like, the breasts are, like, huge, and it's just weird. And hey, I love huge boobies. If you got huge boobies, do whatever you want with them. I'm happy for you. But, you know, it feels like it's not a bell curve of breast size in comics. That's how I'll put it. Right. And I feel like what we saw in your comics so much was body diversity, was even gender diversity in getting to see Freya's fluidity. But then also just like, oh, look, people can be like not clothed very much. And that isn't actually sexy. That's, you know, the warriors, that moment. Oh, my God. When she's like, oh, we don't wear armor because that shows you're tough. And all like the badass sailors are like, damn it. That's really fucking cool. Like, I'm just so curious about how you developed that style there around that, why you love to draw so many different kinds of people. And like, Why are boobies so weird to people? That's another one. I want you to answer. Natasha, I want you on the record to tell me why everyone's weird about boobies. That's
we want to know.
That's the main question.
This is a question for me to answer for all of mankind.
Hey, it is not often that I get to have a couple of lesbians on a call. I want both of you to answer this question for me, okay?
Yay.
As a pansexual person, I need to know.
Gotta explain ourselves.
I just want to thank you for giving people with big boobs permission to do whatever they want with them, because I was like, noted, as he is cool with me doing whatever I want with my boobs. And I was
permission
like,
granted.
I free have the titties, been whatever waiting feels right for the heads up. And so thank you.
I give it to you. I give it to all of our listeners. Do what you want with your titties.
Thank you.
Goodness. I don't even remember what I'm supposed to answer now. Okay.
So it was about...
about boobies.
It became yes about boobies, but it was also about body diversity and drawing yeah characters who have breasts in ways that aren't super sexualized and aren't mm-hmm there to mm-hmm to, you know, titillate. But
I think that probably it's twofold, I think, for me, at least with Heathen. I'm just trying to like put myself back into the mindset of when I was working on it. But I think it's a twofold thing. It's a background in fine arts where I had 3 or 4 different figure drawing classes where literally, you know, every other day you come to class and there's a naked person standing in the middle of the room and like a dozen people around them and you're just drawing them all day and it's just chilling, you're chatting and everybody's fine and there's nothing sexual about it. You're just studying the body and like how it moves and how it is put together, right? Which has always been something that's fascinating to me, you know, as far as like an art subject, just like the human body in general. So that's one part of it. And, you know, I do think that there's something inherently unsexual about it, right? Like that's just the body that people have. It's, you know, what they're doing with it that makes it sexual, or at least that's how I think it should be, right? And then secondly, for Freya specifically, I think it was really important for me to show her as being completely comfortable and like unthreatened by anybody, because she's a god, right? Who is in love with just everybody that she meets. So it was really important for me to depict her in a way that was at the same time like sexy, but not like not threatening in any way and not like she is threatened in any way. Like, because normally if you see a naked woman, you know, she's either about to do something sexy or she's about to have something sexy done to her without her permission or something, right? So yeah, I wanted to avoid that, especially with this goddess character. You know, there's no way she would either do or have done to her, you know, unless it's 100% within her consent or the person she's with consenting. So that was the biggest part of it for me, I think. Yeah.
Well, that really syncs up with her whole storyline and like her mission, right? Like she takes the Valkyrie and she's like, oh, I don't want to go kill a bunch of dudes. Let's have an orgy all the time. And, you know, I would also worship that god is all that I am saying about that. But it's so nice. It's so to see her so filled with hope and to see her so powerful in her sexiness is so delightful. I feel like we don't get to see a lot of women or gender fluid goddesses, gods get to do their thing that way. Mm-hmm. It feels much more like a masculine, like, oh, the strong man is here and he will be manly. And like her strength is in her femininity and her fluidity, right? And mm-hmm. and I think that's such a beautiful piece of the narrative. It's such a contrast, right, to Brunhild, who's being punished through mm-hmm. some kind of love relationship mm-hmm. thing. And it's an interesting contrast to Adis, who is, you know, just on the burgeoning edge of her sexuality, just mm-hmm. figuring it all out. And even though she's, you know, not wearing a lot of clothing, it's not sexual, I feel like, even in the slightest for me. Like, I don't get any super sexy vibes, except for, like, when mm-hmm. she's kissing people. And then I'm like, ooh, she's kissing ladies. Makes me very happy. So I love the way that those narratives reflect one another and how they sort of contrast. And I'm curious why you chose to focus on love, relationships, and connectedness in this kind of narrative, where it's, you know, we've got sort of 3 main characters. They're all experiencing it differently. They're mm-hmm. all experiencing each other differently. Why was love and relationships so important to that?
Well, I knew, you know, once I started exploring the character a little bit and exploring the mythology, I knew a couple things. I said, if I'm going to write this for myself, then I want the main character to be someone like myself. I want them to be a queer woman, young woman who wants to, you know, do the best good that she can in the world, right? And I stumbled upon the story of Brynhild. She's cursed by Odin because of her disobeying of him, and is forced to then, you know, marry whoever frees her from the fire. And it felt like such a perfect little microcosm of like patriarchy, right? That like she has no control over herself. She's once this very powerful leader of the Valkyrie, the kind of person that would strike fear into men's hearts. And now she must be made subservient to a man not of her choosing. And just that story was so like striking to me. And I thought it would resonate really well with Adis if that was a story that she grew up with, like hearing that would be a story interesting to her. And so I wanted to, you know, bring them together. That was like the first step. And then after that, Freya was just kind of a natural like next step for it because, you know, she's exploring those. She kind of like overlaps those same themes of love and like duty and, you know, being cursed by, you know, a system that you have no control over. Yeah. Like, so there was all these overlapping elements that just kind of like, the more I read up on it and the more I kind of like wrote little scenes and stuff, the more it just fell into place. You know, I was like, this is what it is. This is the central theme here is these women and their relationship to relationships.
Yeah, I read in an interview, I think it was your interview with the Hollywood Reporter, mm-hmm. where someone, I think the question was about something about the love relationships. And you were surprised that people were really invested in who Adis was going to end up with, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't really what you had envisioned. And I'm curious for you why, I think I know, but I want to hear you say it, why you resisted that sort of coupling narrative of the like, oh, she's got to be with, you know, either Brynhild or Freya or, you know, a mermaid or one of the pirates or instead, you know, that's not what her arc is. And mm-hmm. I'm curious why you wanted to resist that.
It was really important for me to kind of leave Adis's story kind of open-ended a little bit because, you know, the beginning of her story is about her being punished for, you know, expressing a little bit of, you know, attraction, expressing some kind of love. And so I wanted her to be able to have a journey where she could see that love was still a possibility for her, that, you know, meeting and being with all kinds of people is not like outside of, you know, her reach, even after being banished from her village. It was very important to me that I didn't just nail her down with somebody, especially because she's supposed to be young. You know, she's supposed to be like a teenager, basically. I don't like the idea of in like young adult books and stuff when like teenagers are like, they're in love. And that's how the book ends. It always kind of rubs me the wrong way. I'm like, you're babies. You don't know what love is. Hold on. I was like, just give yourselves a minute. You have more life to live.
Yes, I highly identify with that. I'm always watching TV shows like, they're 20. Why would they be getting married?
Yeah, I really wanted her to know that, you know, I just wanted the world to open up for her, I guess. That's what I wanted. And I think that that's a more hopeful message than her finding somebody. Rather, you know, her just finding like that, you know, the opportunity is there, that it's within her reach.
And it seems to me paired with the other narratives, or, you know, tripled with the other narratives. I don't know how you say three. Braided with the other narratives, let's say. There we go. I'm like, what has three? Braided with the other narratives, it seems to me that there's a message here that is about love, romantic, platonic. I'm just going to call it that for lack of a better term, folks. Mm-hmm. Familial. They're all shades of something similar. Mm-hmm. That's the other piece that I really see you pushing on here. Mm-hmm. And there's something important about Adis not ending up in a relationship. You know, it's important that where Freya, you know, goes to take care of Odin, what an unsurprising turn after their tough narrative, you know, and Brynhild, I won't spoil all of them, goes on to her narrative. That's not what Adis needs. And I think that what I see in that is so often the way queer people are portrayed is, and Sarah and I talk about this all the time, is like, oh, there's two queer characters. They end up together. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's the only thing that can happen.
Yeah, I have married every other queer person I have ever met. Therefore, it is accurate. But
I was just going to say, you know, it's like when people are like, oh, have you met my friend? And you're like, what friend? And they're like, she's gay. And you're like, maybe, but also...
Yeah, I met this other like gay person. So like, if you want to like hook up with
them,
I'm
going to
like
have
just and it's just like It's really weird for you to think that I will be super into the one other gay person, you know.
Yeah, and that's what it reminds me of. Exactly, Sarah, you hit the nail on the head. And I love that she's young and she gets to be free. And there seems to be a piece here that is about polyamory, and maybe not in like the specific way we mean it right now, mm-hmm. but she's expected to have a plurality of loves. The narrative says that, like, yeah, Brunhild really loved this guy. And, like, will she end up with him? Like, who knows? And obviously, Frigga loves everybody. Mm-hmm. And that's beautiful. There isn't a need for it to be, like, the one coupling that matters. And, hey, mm-hmm. listen, I will ship with the best of them. I'm not going to say I wasn't shipping the whole time. I was. In my mind, it was turning into, like, a big polycule. And it was, like, amazing. But I was like, Adis isn't old enough to be in the polycule yet. You know,
I want to read that fan fiction.
Okay, I'm on it. But, yeah, I really appreciated that. I appreciated the way that queer love did not mean queer sex. I appreciated the way queer love did not mean a single queer relationship. It also mm-hmm. meant resistance. It also meant community. It also mm-hmm. meant fighting people who enslave other people. Mm-hmm. And that is the message of what queer love means to me. I got myself all emotional. I'm going to cry. So no, I was totally in love with Heathen for that fact.
Yeah, I think you're right. It maybe wasn't something that I knew at the time when I was writing it, but definitely something I've come to like understand is that so much about like queer love is about kind of smashing those norms of, you know, this is the way you do love. You get men and women get married, have babies, and they, you know, spend 40 years together, and then one of them dies of a heart attack. That's love, right? And you know, queer people are like, no, that's not what it has to be. It could be, you know, whatever it needs to be. You know, it could be two women. It could be two men, it could be like multiple people, it could be theys and thems, you have no idea, you know. That's definitely something like now that I think is very clear in my mind, and maybe was only subconscious when I was working on Heathen, but I'm glad that like comes through, so that's good to know.
Yeah, I'm obsessed, so there you have it. Yeah, I also was like, I read in an interview that you were like, listen, I couldn't put Loki on the page because I was not about to get sued by Marvel.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty hilarious. Yeah. But I loved that you also were working in this universe of, you know, Norse mythology where we were familiar with some things, but then there were lots of things that were new. And I was curious how you decided what to draw from the sort of mythos and like what you wanted to add.
It was just a matter of like literally like Wikipediaing Norse mythology, learning all the characters that I could, all of the key figures and all the little fringe ones, and just picking out the ones that were interesting to me. Not much more complicated than that, except that I knew Odin needed to be there, Brynhild needed to be there, and Freya had to be there. The rest were ancillary, I guess, you know, until I could discover a way that their role could be more specific to the story. Which it worked out. I think it was good to keep it like a limited cast in general.
Totally agreed. I think it really works. The other piece that I think is great about this, about Heathen, is so many talking animals. Like, I love talking animals. I know they're not everybody's cup of tea, but they are extremely my cup of tea. Why are we like, the animals must talk? They must say profound philosophical things. Because they do.
Yeah, I mean, that was just another, you know, that was just an interesting thing that I learned about Norse mythology, about like the wights and stuff, just this idea that there can just be these animal kind of spiritual creatures who, you know, just live amongst us, and they're just other creatures out there doing their thing, and they happen to be immortal, and maybe they could talk, I don't know. I just thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting.
Sarah, that was so funny.
I know.
That I'm is interesting, funny. Bro.
Yeah.
Just like me with like Marge holding up the potato. I'm like, I just think they're neat.
Oh my God.
That's that.
Oh, it's Ghost Rider. Your favorite and mine.
Vroom, vroom, vroom.
Vroom. And then there's a bunch of fire everywhere, flaming skull head, chains, leather jacket, all kinds of cool stuff. So I love Ghost Rider. And anybody who's been listening to this pod, followed me on Twitter, or talked to me in real life probably knows that I love Ghost Rider a lot. And I'll tell you about it
Actually, I will tell you about it on patreon.com/bitchesoncomics because I do a somewhat frequent Ghost Rider Corner. And Ghost Rider Corner is where I talk about my fave and hopefully yours, Ghost Rider. You know,
from patreon.com/bitchesoncomics.
I've been biding my time because I love hearing about Heathen. I could probably talk about this comic much, much longer. But I never realized that you did a zine about Black Phillip.
Oh, yes, I did.
A fanzine, Playdate with the Devil. Mm-hmm. This is amazing. I have never seen anything like this.
Thank you.
What made you want to do a fanzine specifically about our friend Black Phillip?
Well, I love that movie. I love The Witch. I read this article. For the life of me, I wouldn't be able to find it or tell you where I saw it, but it was basically like Satanists were talking about how that movie was like the perfect Satanist like allegory. If you haven't seen The Witch, sorry, here's some spoilers. There's this family that kind of like are destroying themselves from within with their paranoia, their superstitions and stuff, turning on one another, especially turning on their daughter, who is just, you know, living her life, growing up and becoming a woman, something she can't help but to do. And then at the end of it, once they've all turned on each other and ruined themselves, the devil's like, hey, do you want to come hang out with me? And I was just like, that's amazing. I just thought it was incredible. So I just imagined like a little microcosm of that where the little goat is just going around and just kind of doing that with all sorts of people. He just finds somebody. He's like, hey, you want to come with me? let's have a nice little day.
That it's my favorite thing ever. Is it still available?
There's digital copies available on my Gumroad store. Alterisi.gumroad.com, I think. And I have print copies that I occasionally sell when I have enough of them. I might be right out right now.
That is amazing. I'm going to have to check it out. I love the pitch. I think that maybe Black Phillip has a fandom, right?
Like, I think so, yeah.
There has to be people who are just diehard into Black Phillip more than just present company. So I was also curious because you've done so much work on covers. Like you've done so many, like the covers of so many books that are really great books. And you've worked with a lot of people like Vita and, you know, Erica Schultz and like a lot of people who we've actually had on the podcast before. So I'm just kind of curious to hear about it because we haven't had a lot of people, I don't think, that specifically have done so much work on covers.
Really?
So what is the process a little bit like? Like, do you read the script beforehand or like how does covers usually work?
Usually for me, you know, most of the cover work I get is just through friends or people that have seen my work online or whatever. But they'll send me like a little sample of the comic. If they have a full issue, they'll usually send me that or just like a handful of pages, enough that I like get the idea. And then we just discuss ideas if they have any. If they don't, then I just sort of riff on it. I come up with my own ideas. I'll send them a few sketches and then we go from there. I like doing covers. I like the design aspect of it, trying to create an eye-catching kind of illustration that will hopefully sell people the comic without having to, like, flip it open. I kind of wish I got to do more of it. We'll see. Hopefully more.
Yeah, hopefully more, because your covers are really great. I'm just thinking about the covers of Heathen and how every single one of them, I'm like, yeah, I'll buy that comic for sure. Like, that looks awesome.
Nice. I did like my like original Heathen covers where I kind of did like this red background and I just focused on one character at a time. And I feel like I've kind of like taken that idea and applied it to a lot of different projects, hopefully with a little bit more creativity. But it's definitely something I want to like flex my wings on in the future.
I hope you get to, because they all look great.
Thank you.
But what is your background? Because I noticed that you've put out so many zines. I love zines. I believe I was making zines before I was making just about anything else in my life. So I'm just curious how you came into making zines and why it's a medium that continues to appeal to you.
Let's see. Well, before I started work on Heathen, I had to do a little short comic for this like online comics class that I took. It was on like Canvas or something. It was free. And we read a bunch of comics during the class, and then at the end of it, everybody just made a little short comic, 6 pages or whatever. And I made one, which is Girls Don't Like Dinosaurs, which is free on my website, alterisi.gumroad.com. Girls Don't Like Dinosaurs. That was the first comic I ever like did, like writing, art, lettering, start to finish, all by myself. And it's free for everybody. But that like practice was kind of really like fundamental, I felt like. So anytime I found myself just kind of really, really, really interested in a subject, something that probably isn't like enough material to like commit to a full like series or graphic novel or whatever, or it's just something I just need to get out of my system like short term, then I'll let myself obsess over it and do a short comic. I try to stick to like 8 pages or whatever, and just literally no off, like nothing's like off limits for those. Just whatever is interesting to me, I'm going to like sit down and obsess over it until I have produced something at the end of it. And it's been a lot of fun, and I really, really hope that I can get back to making a lot more of those, because I have a million ideas for zines.
Have you done a lot of any kind of zine fest or anything along those lines, or is it mostly online that you sell zines?
Mostly just online. I've got to do like a local one a couple of years ago. But in general, I don't like make it out to conventions and stuff. So mostly just selling those online.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. And that's something that is not just valid, but it's how a ton of people are doing it now. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Zine fests are really fun. So that's always like why I ask that question, is because it's like whenever I go, I'm just like, it's usually just a bunch of queer kids who are like mm-hmm. super nice to me because I made queer zines or something. So I'm just like, this is great. Like everybody is so nice. And it's like a nice little like break from the world or something, you know?
Yeah. I was just going to say, I got to go to a Comic-Con in Columbus, Ohio, and there were a bunch of like students there on one of the days, and they had all, I think, been in like a zine making class because they were walking around with their little paper folded up zines and just like trading them with people. And I got like 12 of those. And I was like, yes, I'm so excited to get so many little zines. People are so creative with those. And it really like, I think, is the best expression of what the medium can do. Especially because you're limited in such a small amount of pages. It's just like, whatever you have to say, like, make it count, you know? I love them.
Mm-hmm. And also, yeah, just kind of, it's all you, you know, like mm-hmm. most of the time. There's some collaborative zines, obviously, but for the most part, people are going, hey, this is just the thing that I made, and it doesn't have to go through a bunch of editors and, mm-hmm. you know, all of the things. I have a friend who teaches, actually probably more than one friend, now that I think about it, that teaches making zines to mm-hmm. kids. And whenever they pull out the zine collection to like flip through and just show me what the kids came up with, is like, possibly one of the best experiences of my life every mm-hmm. single time, because it's just like, oh my God.
They're so good.
Then it's a whole thing now. Like zine artists, you know, are also published and all of that stuff. I think probably whenever I was first starting zines, it was still kind of niche where mm-hmm. people would be like, do you pronounce it zines? Yeah. But it's kind of changed since then and become a lot more mainstream. And I love how you're talking about doing it, where it's just like you do it whenever you have a specific interest that you don't really want to go through a whole publishing process around.
Yeah.
And you sell it online, and that's amazing. Like as somebody who like grew up like reading a lot of like punk zines and paper zines and mm-hmm. stuff like that, and you find them in weird places and you know, all of that kind of stuff. Like I think it's so cool how zines have evolved over time and how they continue to evolve so that like there's so many people who make them, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Ah, zines.
Well, and while we're on the topic of zines, you have a bunch of cool ones in your Gumroad and on your website.
Yeah.
So you talked about Girls Don't Like Dinosaurs. I almost introduced you as Natashasaurus Rex, for the record. But then I was like, too silly or not silly enough, TBD. That is such a sweet and fun comic. So that's your very first sequential comic you've done?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. I guess some people just get to be extremely talented.
Well, that would have been like probably like maybe a year or so after college. So I was like fresh. It was like the peak of my game.
Maybe one of the peaks, maybe an early peak. I think there are peaks ahead. But another one is the Anarchist Coloring Book, which is so much fun. I particularly laughed out loud at your disclaimer at the end, which was obviously smart. But so for those of you who haven't checked it out, oh my gosh, go buy the Anarchist Coloring Book. It's very cool. It's like these anthropomorphic badass anarchists who are just like under slogans and like eat the rich and like no one's gonna help you but you. You know, oh, man, I'm obsessed with it. I love it. It's so much fun. What, you know, is that one of those ideas you were talking about that was like kind of like a pebble in your shoe? You just like had to get it out.
For sure. I started drawing those characters, or at least versions of them, probably right after the 2016 election, which, you know, was kind of a moment for a lot of us. and they slowly kind of evolved. I thought in my head that I was going to do some kind of like story with them. I was going to write them a little short comic. But like, the more I got into it, the more I was like, well, am I going to be like, you know, I was like, they're going to be anarchists and I want them to, you know, have this kind of broad sort of ideology, but I didn't want to make any prescriptions like this is what you have to do or whatever, or this is like, you know, this is the right way to do this. Mm. I wanted it to be more of like a community thing, right? So that's why I've made it a printable thing that you can take and you can make as many copies as you want. I don't care, as many as you want. I don't have copyright on these. They're free domain for the world. Color them however you want. You can edit them, plaster them all over the side of city buildings. Don't do that. I didn't say that. That's illegal.
No one said that. That didn't happen.
Nobody said that. And then I, you know, hope to keep making like more illustrations, just to talk about the ideals of anarchism, because I just, you know, found myself getting like more and more like interested in it. Like you said, it's just another little brainworm, another little pebble in my shoe, a thing I needed to explore a little bit more. And I always explore topics best if I get to draw them. So that's what I did.
Yeah, it's lovely. I mean, for me, I even just, you know, read through it as another zine. I haven't printed it, though I might. And I just found it really inspiring. I think there's so much misunderstanding of what anarchy is. And so when you share a book like that, that is humanizing, even like through an anthropomorphic way, it breaks down those sort of assumptions we have about what anarchy really means.
Frequently
can be found ranting about what anarchy actually is.
Listen,
when people, I'm like, listen, it's self-governing. And people are like, I don't get it. And I'm like, that's the point and the problem. And they're like, well, I'm going to go talk to someone else at this party who's not yelling at me about anarchy. I'm like, okay, I'm going to have the coloring book instead to hand to people. And I'll be like, here's a soft landing.
Yeah.
When you're done coloring this and contemplating it, come back to me and we can discuss. I'll be everyone's like tutor out in the world, anarchy tutor. Another zine that I thought was really evocative is Brother's Keeper. And so this is one of you. This is the comic where you talked about wanting to talk about guns in the U.S., but the last thing you wanted to do was draw a bunch of guns. So instead, you drew dinosaurs.
Yeah.
And it is such an incredible commentary / satire. And I'm curious, how do you think the dinosaurs ended up functioning in the comic? And are you happy with how that came across?
I think it came across pretty well. You know, for me, it wasn't just about like, you know, a gun per se, but really gun culture, this kind of toxic masculine society that's raising boys to be violent, even if they're not explicitly saying that. Just all of these little things that kind of build up through these boys' life kind of leads them to this inevitable conclusion where one of them ends up being, you know, a full-blown white supremacist terrorist, and the other ends up being, you know, an armed agent of the state. And, you know, you might be tempted to walk away from it thinking that, you know, one of them ended up good and one of them ended up bad. But if you pay a little closer attention, you might see that they're like two sides of the same coin almost. And the thing about gun violence is that I don't get it. Like, I look at guns and I'm like, I don't see what's so interesting about that. I don't understand why people are obsessed with them. Like, they're just scary and dangerous, right? So I had to think about something that was scary and dangerous to me, but I also thought was cool. And so it was kind of a natural conclusion that I would have to draw dinosaurs. So, and I was like, and I could do that. I could draw dinosaurs as many times as I have to, as many as I need.
I feel like drawing dinosaurs is one of your passions.
For sure.
Yeah, I mean, it just works so well in Brother's Keeper. I was like, not sure what I was going to read. I was like, okay, so like, Are they holding little dinosaurs? Which would have been hilarious and probably not gotten your point across the same way.
Might have been too silly.
Too silly. But it was really harrowing. And as you say, you know, you get to the end and it's just like heartbreaking. The way that the, you know, one of the protagonists ends up feeling about the dinosaur. And one of the things I love is when there's sort of a layered narrative happening, right? Because we know it's about dinosaurs, but we also know it's about gun culture.
Exactly.
And so there's just this like, you know, that last panel just, whew, it cut me deep. I thought it was amazing. And I just am really, really grateful I read it. And I can't believe, like, you know, all these things were on your Gumroad for, like, you know, a song. So everybody should go check them out. And then the last one I just have to, from the zine that I just, like, we have to talk about because I think it's going to open us up into another conversation that I want to hear your thoughts on, is your Oksana paper doll / fanzine, which is, I can't remember what you said, like the dress up assassin, something like that. Yeah. Is like the title. It's freaking hysterical. So obviously this is a Villanelle from Killing Eve.
Yes.
So, okay. Why did you need to make a paper doll from Killing Eve? And do you also love Killing Eve? Tell me everything.
Of course. Yeah, that was the reason. I saw people talking about it online forever. And they're just like, you've got to watch the show. You're going to love it. You need to watch the show. And I finally was like, okay, I will sit down and I will read it. Or I will sit down and watch it. I haven't read the books yet. I've heard they're good, but I haven't checked them out yet. But no, I got obsessed with the show. Like immediately, I was immediately hooked. Villanelle is such a fascinating character, you know, that female assassin who is, she's hard to describe, right? She's just like this little kind of manic, wild, childish even, but like weird and funny and sexy and dangerous, like just this fireball of a character. And then you pair her up with someone who is just so like magnanimous and like awesome as Sandra Oh. And you just, it's an amazing combo. I love that show. But this was probably the first time I got interested in fashion, like in, like as a subject on like overall, just all her different outfits and the way she just sort of like plays up this kind of glamorous sort of facade on top of her very like broken, weird self. It was just really interesting to me. And I was like, I need to like see all of her outfits and I just need to be able to like swap them out. And I thought, you know, how fun would it be if you could just make a little like a little fashion paper doll kind of thing. yeah, it just kind of stuck in my brain. And I was like, I got to do it now. I have to do it because I thought that I could do it. Now I have to.
You're like, well, you know what? The decision's been made. I thought of it and now it has to happen.
Brain decided for me.
You know, I think it's interesting, too, when we think about Villanelle this is the connection my brain is making with Adis is, you know, Adis wears nothing as her armor. Mm-hmm. And then for Villanelle, right, like fashion is a form of her armor. Mm-hmm. When we see her in those couple of episodes where she's stuck in that person's house. Yes. And she has no access to her fashion. She has no mm-hmm. access to like. You know, control how she presents in the world. Mm-hmm. It is such a vulnerability that we don't see in Oksana outside of that moment. And so I think it's so interesting the way that's paralleling, even though like, you know, they clearly came from very different places, but it does seem to be there's something about armor and, you know, girding oneself for battle or mm-hmm. not. And you know, how that defines a character somewhere in here.
Yeah. But one of my favorite moments is like, I think it's either like the first or second episode where she's like, they're taking Oksana to be like assessed by like the, you know, whatever this is, like assassin's psychologist dude or whatever. And she puts on that like super frilly pink dress and she just kind of like looks at her handler guy and she just kind of gives him a look like, look at me. Are you impressed? And I'm just like, it's such a funny like moment to me, but it also is, it just tells you so much about the character that there's something super immature about her, but it's really interesting. I like what they do with all the outfits.
Yeah, me too. I think that show's legit. I don't mm-hmm. think I've seen the most recent season. So now I'm like, oh shit, maybe I'll go do that tonight.
I think there's three. I think the fourth one's coming out soon.
Yeah, I believe so.
The last one. Oh.
Yeah. Very exciting, very mm-hmm. sad. So the only other thing I had, and Sarah, I don't know what else is on your docket, but I know that in this year, in 2021, you had a short comic in Women of Marvel come out. Mm-hmm. And this is, oh my God, it's so cute. You know, Mystique is like on an archaeological dig, kind of. And then Rogue shows up like on the school trip. And then it's just like mom-daughter feels. Oh my God, I can't even. It was so cute. I was like, I'm going to die. I'm going to physically die from how adorable every line in this is. And I'm curious, were you, you know, did you get to choose who you wrote about? And what made you want to tell a story about, you know, this mother-daughter combo?
Yes, we did get to choose. There were like a few characters that had already been like picked or claimed. So they were off limits. But in general, you know, I had my pick of Marvel women. And I, you know, have always loved X-Men movies. You know, I grew up on those original three X-Men movies, probably all-time favorites. And, you know, Mystique is such a fascinating character in there. But then, you know, when you read the comics, like there's so much more to her than, you know, what the movies were able to like give us. So I started like reading more about her backstory and like finding some of those older issues where like her and Rogue have like this whole dynamic between them that's really like kind of fascinating. And also just, you're right. It's like, it's just like fun to like explore her being this kind of mischievous troublemaker. And her daughter just trying to like, you know, resist her, like, just like, get away from me. Leave me alone, mom. Like, I'm trying to be a good person. You're trying to recruit me to evil. No, no, get away. I don't know. I just think that's super interesting.
And so cute. Like, it's really so cute. Yeah. Cute.
And then I got my choice of settings. You know, I was like, I gotta fit some dinosaurs into this story somehow. If this is my one chance to write a Marvel story, I'm going to put some dinosaurs in it. And I looked up if there were like dinosaur characters from Marvel, and I read about Stegron, and I was like, yes, this is it. This is perfect.
Done and done. I will be including him. Yeah, dinosaurs seems to be a like continuous thread in your work. And I know that I read in an interview, and I couldn't tell you which one, that part of the root of that is seeing Jurassic Park when you were really young.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, like, how old were you when you saw it?
I was probably six, yeah.
Six, okay. I think we were like around the same age. Mm-hmm. And it to me is like such a, like when I think of like what's the best film, I'm not saying that I think I'm right, but Jurassic Park always comes to mind because I'm like, that shit
it's
scared
a good movie.
Me so much. It was so thrilling. Samuel Jackson is hilarious in it. Mm-hmm. Newman is also hilarious in it. Like, gotta love that movie. But what's your favorite part? B, do you like the sequels?
My favorite part is the first time that they see the Brachiosaurus, when they step out and they like look up and they're all in awe. Like, it makes me cry like every single time. Like, it's such a well like filmed scene, and like the music wells up, and then you just get this sense of like wonder and awe, and I'm like, whoa, just like gives me chills every time. I'm like, these people have been studying dinosaurs their whole life, and now they get to see them. You know, it's just like, it's really emotional.
It's so emotional.
It's so good. And then, you know, they slide you into the horror, so it's just like, oh, here we go. The sequels, I love the sequels, the original, like two and three, like Lost World and Jurassic Park 3. I love those movies. Like, I know people are on the like hate train for Jurassic Park 3, but it's like a bazillion times better than either of the Jurassic World movies, I would say anyway. Don't get me started about the Jurassic World movies. We'd be talking for like another hour about how much you like those movies.
So we'll have you back for that conversation, because obviously
I do love to hate those movies, though. So it's a balance, you know.
I spend a lot of time being like, really, really, this is our best female character now. Where's Laura Dern? Where's Laura fucking Dern? That's me the whole time. I imagine Sarah's also doing the same thing. But Sarah's also always like, where's Laura Dern right now?
Just that's like just a face. General question on my mind.
We gotta know. Is she okay? What's going on?
I haven't heard from her.
Just looking out. Lesbians love Laura Dern, and I love that about lesbians.
Don't know how to not. Yeah. It's just like, oh yeah, that was part of the handbook that they give out.
Oh my God, you're killing me. Okay, I also love all three of them. Is the third one the one with the pterodactyls and William H. Macy?
Yes, 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 oh. Yes, yes.
Those pterodactyls are... Oh, Taya Leone! Oh,
Taya Leone and William H. Macy, they're perfect in that movie. I love them. They have so much charm to them.
Absolutely. And like, I'm sorry, pterodactyls are fucking terrifying.
They
like,
are.
That was,
oh my God.
So, like, when they're like jumping between those like scaffoldings and you're like, jump! And then Like a pterodactyl's like, delicious!
There's a little fog and you can't like see the ceiling and then it clears away and you're like, oh no, we're in a cage. It's good. That's really good.
Oh my God. Good stuff. Well, you know what? Vindication! I feel much better knowing that you also liked the third one. Sarah, did you have any other questions?
You know what? I don't, except for, so what's coming up?
What's coming up for me? I have a new graphic novel that I am signing contracts for right now. It's called Wildflowers. I probably can't tell you too much more about it. We're still in the process of hammering out the details. But hopefully that will be, I'll start work on that pretty soon. And then other than that, I'm kind of taking a little bit of a hiatus to hopefully get my hand fixed. If anybody doesn't know, I've been dealing with some pretty severe hand pains for the last couple of years. And I just set up a GoFundMe. The link is on my Twitter and on my Instagram. If you guys are willing and able, no pressure, 100% no pressure. Yeah, that would be great if you could help me out with that. Get my hand fixed and I can draw again. Yay.
This is the future that liberals want. Like, I want to see more yes. comics drawn.
I want to make more. I have so many more I want to make.
We will absolutely yeah. share the GoFundMe in our show notes, as well as sharing your Patreon and your Gumroad. Do you want to tease anything about your Patreon?
The Patreon is, I'm not sure what is going to happen with the future of that. It's kind of dependent on how things go with my hands. And how soon I can get back into making zines, kind of up in the air right now. So you don't, no pressure to pledge to that because I'm not sure how much longer I'll have it around. We'll see. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Patreon's a tricky one.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then where can people find you on social media?
I am on Twitter at Alterici, Alterici, and on Instagram at Alterici_art. Those are the two places.
Fantastic. And again, if you didn't have your pen out, we will include that in the show notes so you can go follow Natasha and support all of her amazing projects. Tasha, it has been a ding-dang delight to talk to you today. I really appreciate your time, your energy, your enthusiasm for all things queer and femme and, you know, honestly, dinosaurs, which in Jurassic Park, they're all ladies. So, you know,
it's feminism. Yeah.
Exactly. but yeah, thank you so much, Sarah. I appreciate you. You are, as always, perfect. Kate, thanks for editing our sound. You're also perfect. Listeners, you're the most perfectest of all. We love you. Thank you for listening to Bitches on Comics. We are a bi-weekly podcast where we talk to your favorite comics and pop culture creators and critics about what matters to them in comics and pop culture, as you might have guessed. You can follow us on Twitter at @BitchesOnComics and on Instagram at @BitchesOnComics. Our website is, brace yourself, bitchesoncomics.com. If you go there, you can listen to any of our episodes, and we've got other shit that we put on tabs. I don't remember what it is. I am in charge of updating the website, however, so good luck.
Thanks for the heads up. I'll go to this website now.
If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by rating and reviewing us on iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Sarah Century, and you can find me at www.sarahcentury.com and Twitter and Instagram. Still Sarah Century on those.
I'm Essie Fleenor. You can learn more about me at essiefleenor.com. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at @SE_Fleenor.
Bitches on Comics is recorded by Kate Warner, who plays in the band Churchfire. You can find them at churchfiremusic.com. Our music is recorded by Katie Taylor, who plays as Earth Control Pill. You can find her music at earthcontrolpill.bandcamp.com.
Bitches on Comics is recorded in Denver, Colorado. We want to recognize the indigenous peoples who have inhabited and do inhabit this land. The Arapaho Nation, the Ute Nation, the Cheyenne Nation, and others who have been erased from our history and collective memories through colonization.